Money FM 89.3, Best of Weekends. International News Review.
What do you get, Cap?
Steve Okun joining us right now for our International News Review. Steve, good morning. Welcome.
You mean the evolved Steve Okun?
Ooh.
Right? You are evolved. I mean, just look at that artwork behind you. Look at your brick wall.
I'm liking the brick wall.
Yeah,
it's cool.
You're very evolved, Steve. I've always known that about you. Hey, Steve. He's back, isn't he? He's back. There's even a gold statue of him. Who am I talking about?
You are talking about, of course, the former president of the United States, Donald Trump. And, you know, there's this event called CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference. Mm. And Donald Trump Jr. spoke Saturday U.S. time and said they should rename it TPAC because it is all about Donald Trump.
Oh, my God.
It's all about Trump.
Okay. So tell us what the importance of this CPAC conference is, because in many ways it looks like a campaign rally from what I've seen so far. And it's going to even look more so, I think, on Sunday when Donald Trump speaks. But what is the importance of these political action committees for those who might not be aware of it or understand it?
Well, this one, where it is today versus where it was, it tells the story, to use a story terminology, right? So that tells the story, because it used to be that it's not part of the Republican Party, but this was bringing together conservatives to move the Republican Party in a more conservative direction. So it was, you know, it was all about, you know, lowering taxes, deregulation, keep the government out of my business. Strong military, strong foreign policy, very hawkish in that way. And that's where it was. And Donald Trump has basically taken over CPAC. And now it's really in his image. So conservatives are no longer what the conservatives used to be, which is what I just all described.
Yeah.
It is now, it's anti-adventurism, anti-big tech, anti-immigration, anti-China, anti-lockdowns. That was the governor of Florida who spoke yesterday. And that's where the Republican Party is headed. And it's a real difference to where it was before.
How fascinating about the anti-big tech, because that's what's pulling the economy in the U.S. right now. A lot of other industries are doing really badly, so the stock market in the U.S. would be heavily impacted if it wasn't for those big tech companies.
Well, this is where you have the Republicans and Democrats aligned, because what the Republicans are saying by anti-big tech, and it's all about cancel culture, right? And it's the liberals who have taken over Facebook and Google, as they would say, and Twitter, and are keeping conservative voices off of social media. They're canceling us. And that is, and we need to do something about that. Democrats, on the other hand, their concern is, they have a little bit of that concern on tech too, but they also see the monopoly power that's come about, you know, where Facebook owns not only Facebook, but they own Instagram, they own WhatsApp, they integrate it, you know, all together and keep competition out. So the anti-big tech is coming from both the progressives and the Trump conservative wing of the Republican Party. So that's why CPAC is anti-big tech. Yeah.
It's been interesting, Steve, that we have literally heard like nothing from Trump since the inauguration, right? He has been very quiet. A couple of small things here and there.
Isn't he banned off of Twitter? Isn't that why it's
He was banned off of Twitter for sure. But he had a slight dust up with Mitch McConnell just last week or 2 weeks ago. But basically, he's been very quiet. And that, to me, indicates that somebody is giving him some good advice, lay low, and then make a big reappearance at this CPAC conference. Is that the way you see it, or do you see it differently?
Well, the tradition, of course, and Donald Trump has blown up all traditions when it comes to governing and politics. But the tradition was you let the old president lays low for a year or more. You give the new president a chance to establish himself. You're out of office. Barack Obama laid low. George W. Bush laid low. Bill Clinton laid low. I mean, that's the way it's always been done. You know, we're barely a month out of the Trump presidency. Mike Pence turned down an invitation to speak at CPAC because he felt that he should not be out there so quickly. Mm. He needs to give the new administration its own chance. Donald Trump doesn't believe that way. So this is actually very fast that Trump is coming back in, and he wants to be in charge of the Republican Party. And he's going to attack people like Liz Cheney, like other members of Congress who voted to impeach him. And he is going to try and have he's going to try and be the golden idol for his party.
That statue is something else. Speaking of golden idols. So we had the crowd there booing reminders to wear masks. I would imagine we'll see another super spreader event probably in another 2-3 weeks time happening from there. So I guess we'll just have to wait and see what happens. Good news for Joe Biden in that his first legislative victory has occurred in the passing through the House of this $1.9 trillion stimulus package for vaccines and lots of other things. Now, there is controversy around that, though, because of the push for the $15 minimum wage in the U.S. Is that in any way going to sour this other achievement of getting money out there to help with the pandemic?
You know, only if the Democrats want it to sour. Certain Democrats want it to sour. So the way this works in the U.S. is you need to have 60 votes in the Senate to really pass any significant legislation, unless you use a process called reconciliation. And the reconciliation process can only be used for budgetary purposes. So what happened is most of the things in the $1.9 trillion stimulus, like giving money to state governments, to give the $1,400 stimulus checks to individuals, to help pay for the vaccine rollout, all of that is within the budgetary process. But the Democrats also wanted to use this budgetary process to raise the minimum wage, more than double it to $15 an hour. The Senate parliamentarian said that is not allowed under these budget rules. So the Senate cannot have it in its bill. Mm-hmm. And so now the question is, what are the progressives going to try and do? Are they going to take, you know, not even half a loaf? Are they going to take, you know, 95% of what they want? Or are they going to try and find another way to fight for this $15 minimum wage? Or do they save it for another day? It looks like, and politically, what they should do is get this bill passed. It is very popular. No Republicans are going to vote for it, yet it's popular with 60 to 70% of the American people. Take the victory and find a way to raise the minimum wage down the road. But that's what's going to happen. The question is, what will the Democrats led by, you know, Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren and the squad in the House do to try and keep some way to raise the minimum wage through the reconciliation process? Hmm.
Sounds like you have a very active minor bird in the background.
Welcome to Singapore.
The beauty of living in the tropics, yeah. On the equator. Yeah. Yeah. All right, Steve. We'll leave the stimulus for now because I know that, you know, there's a lot more that has to be done with that. It still has to get through the Senate, and the mere fact that they're going to do it probably through reconciliation will rankle some people. There's this other question just around that, in that in 2009 the Republicans were all about doing, you know, big funding for restarting the economy, et cetera. The Democrats were. The Republicans said, no, it's too much. And then they won in the midterm elections very big because of that stand. Now, this time around, with the Republicans saying no to helping the American people who are hurting, are they taking a chance on risking blowback in the elections in 2 years' time?
I mean, that is their risk. And the Democratic analogy, because the lesson the Democrats learned from 2009 when the Democrats passed the stimulus was that it wasn't big enough. It didn't do enough to help people.
Right.
And so they lost, not because they didn't go big enough. So the Democrats are saying, we need to hit this with everything we can to get the economy addressed and knock COVID out as quickly as possible. And if we're spending too much money, so what? It's better to go too big than too small. Yeah. The Republicans don't want to give Biden a victory. They don't want to give the Democrats a victory. So they're stuck between a rock and a hard place, but they're going to hold tight. And this is going to really dictate in part what's going to happen 2 years from now. Do the Democrats keep the House and the Senate in addition to the White House? And this is really a big play by the Democrats to do that.
All right, let's move on to the U.S. Trade Representative, something that I think will be interesting to our Singapore listeners and how it might relate to what we will see here in Asia. Catherine Tai, who is President Biden's top trade nominee, she said that she backed tariffs as a legitimate tool to counter China during her confirmation hearings. How is she sounding? How is she looking to both Republicans and Democrats who will have to decide her future as whether or not she'll be the next USTR?
She's looking very good to both parties, because she was a big part of the USMCA, the US-Mexico-Canada agreement that was signed and renegotiated and then signed by President Trump with Canada in Mexico. And she fought as she was a lawyer in the Congress at the time, and you know, she was negotiating on behalf of the Democrats to make sure that there were strong labor rights in that agreement and strong environmental protections in that agreement, that, of course, the two parties came together and passed that. So she has strong bipartisan support. And one of the things that she talked about at length at her hearing was about workers, and that we need to make trade policy work for workers. And she said we have to think about workers not just as, you know, those blue collar union labor workers, but we have to think about farmers who are workers. We have to think about the people who work for tech companies who are workers. So she's going to take a much more expansive approach when negotiating. And that's really fitting in line with where Donald Trump is, in part, and where certainly the more moderate or the more liberal progressive wing of the Democratic Party. So she has a very strong support, and she'll sail through Congress with her confirmation.
It's interesting because during the Senate Finance Committee hearing that she's been going through, she did not reject Trump's America First trade policies. But as you just alluded to, she wants to revamp them to a worker-centric model that safeguards American jobs through investment and trade enforcement. That is a traditionally kind of Democratic, you know, positioning. But do you think it's getting some resonance with Republicans?
Oh, for sure. And I think the question is, how do you, though, balance this with the economic interest of the United States, with not ceding the playing field to China in Asia and Southeast Asia, where you have China moving forward on trade with RCEP, you have China moving forward with an EU negotiation. If you could potentially have a China, Japan, Korea free trade agreement, and the U.S. is kept out of everything, that is no good for the United States either. Mm. So the balance is, how do you do both of these things? And I think using the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement as a template, you can do a trade agreement. You can't say, well, we're going to protect workers, and you protect workers by not doing trade. Mm. So it is going to take a year or two for that balance to be worked out, but I think that she will have the credibility to do that as much as any U.S. trade representative could with both Democrats and Republicans.
Mm, very interesting. Catherine Tai, of course, Yale and Harvard law educated, daughter of U.S. immigrants from Taiwan. Does her history, her parentage, her lineage, does that mean anything to us here in Asia? Should it mean anything to us here in Asia? Will she treat Asia any differently than any of her predecessors?
I think it means more in terms of her knowledge of China, because when you're fluent in a language as she is, and you can not only, you know, speak Mandarin, but write Mandarin, where you can negotiate with somebody in their native tongue, it makes for a different negotiation. And it you don't have to be fluent to be able to do that. You're obviously not going to be fluent in every language in which you're negotiating a trade agreement, but I think it gives a little bit more of an insight than and you don't rely on your staff, and if the staff isn't as good, then maybe you're going to be in a different shape. So I think it's going to bring more of a nuanced approach to China, and it's going to maybe change how China negotiates with the U.S.
Hmm. All right. Our final story, Steve, is one that it's troublesome, I think, it's troublesome to me, I'll be honest with you, and a lot of other people. And this was the killing of dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi in the Saudi consulate in Turkey. And a declassified CIA intelligence report came out that concluded this week, it was released, the prince in Saudi Arabia, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman was actually responsible. He ordered the operation to capture or kill Khashoggi in 2018. Now, this has been released, but then slightly after that, the Biden administration came out and said, well, we're really not going to do anything about it. I'm oversimplifying and paraphrasing. this is a point, I think, that many people were interested in seeing, you know, how much the Biden administration would stand up to Saudi Arabia. Are you surprised at all when you seen what's happened over this past week with this story? Any angle on it?
No, I mean, I think it shows the real difficult choices you have to make in governing. You know, here you had an action that, you know, a horrific murder that took place, you know, 2 years ago that the U.S. government had known, because this report was not just done. This report was done, you know, in the past by the intelligence agencies. The U.S. didn't do anything. It sanctioned certain people who were directly involved, but not those who were responsible for calling for the action, as you said. And then now the Biden administration says, okay, what are we going to do 2 years later? Do we take the step of sanctioning, prohibiting a government official to come to the United States anymore, who is an ally of our country, who we need in terms of confronting Iran, who we need to bring, you know, more stability to the Middle East, who we need when it comes to China's influence in the region to work with them. And so they came down on the side of, we're going to punish in the fact that we're going to release this document and we're going to make the declassified version of the report clear to everybody what happened and why it happened. And we're going to sanction others who are involved, but for realpolitik reasons, we're not going to go the full way. And there's been a lot of criticism, you know, and from the New York Times columnists and others that he should have, that Biden should have held, you know, MBS personally responsible. But I think they, you know, said we're trying to find some middle ground. And usually when you look for middle ground, you don't make anybody happy. Right. You went too far. You didn't go far enough. But that's where they came down.
Interesting. We'll see. Apparently, Biden said he was going to make some kind of announcement early this coming week, maybe on Monday or Tuesday, about this, some further additional announcements. So we'll see what that is. Steve, thank you very much. I know you're going to be on the Breakfast Huddle tomorrow morning at, I think, 7:30 or so with Elliot Denker and Manisha Tank. So I believe you'll be updating the CPAC, what happened, what Trump actually said, et cetera. Is that correct?
Yeah, we will get to it. Well, I think Trump should have gone by then. It'll be close. Yeah. So, yeah, that'll be
he might not be finished by then, but he will have started by then.
Well, I'm sure one of the rules for storytelling is don't go on for an hour and a half.
I think Trump is his own little like story by himself. He just shows up and you're just like, did you just say that? Okay. I think he's going after like the shock effect always. Doesn't stop.
All right, Steve, thank you very much.
He doesn't mix it up, right?
Yeah.
One way only.
That's true. Thanks for your time today, Steve. Appreciate it.
Great being with both of you. Thanks.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
To listen to more great interviews, download our podcasts at moneyfm893.sg or download the SBH radio app available on Google Play or the App Store.